driven by your ability to develop the employee, as in the item, "There is someone at work who encourages my development." When an employee comes up to you and asks the inevitable, "Where do I go from here? Can you help me grow?" you need to know what to say. Should you help each person get promoted? If you tell an employee to attend some training classes and pay her dues, is that the right thing to say? Perhaps you feel as though you are too close to your people. Can you ever get too close to them? What happens if you have to terminate someone you have come to care about? What do you owe your people anyway? Your answers to all of these questions will guide you as you try to set up each person for success, both in the current role and beyond. Select a person, set expectations, motivate the person, and develop the person. These are the four core activities of the catalyst role. If a company's managers are unable to play this role well, then no matter how sophisticated its systems or how inspirational its leaders, the company will slowly start to disintegrate. In the early 1990s, one of the leading hospitality companies began experimenting with self-managed work teams as a replacement for the traditional manager role. This was the brainchild of a top industry executive whose flood of new ideas was matched only by his passion in presenting them. He envisioned a hotel of teams. Each team would comprise a balanced roster of housekeepers, front desk clerks, bellhops, maintenance staff, and table servers. The employees on each team would manage themselves, setting schedules, assigning duties, and disciplining colleagues. To encourage mutual support, all praise and recognition would be meted out at the team level. To encourage individual growth, each employee would be able to increase his pay only by learning how to play each of the other roles on the team. The more roles he learned, the more he would earn. All of this would be monitored by a couple of managers whose chief responsibility was not to manage the people, but to ensure the smooth running of the new team structure. It was an inspired plan with only one flaw. It didn't work. The employees liked the idea of supporting one another, as all great hotel employees do, but the team structure threw them into confusion. The best housekeepers didn't want to become front desk clerks. They liked housekeeping. Front desk clerks didn't like table serving. And the table servers, looking up from their own troubles behind the reception desk, didn't appreciate the mess the front desk clerks were making of their precious restaurant. Each employee came to feel as though he was in the wrong role. He no longer knew clearly what was expected of him. He no longer felt competent, and with the focus on team rather than individual excellence, he no longer felt important. Arguments broke out, guests complained, and the few remaining managers, forced to support novices in every role, dashed around and about fighting fires, spinning plates. It was a mess. The chief designer kept trying to rally the troops, but the slide continued. In the end, the hotel was forced to revert back to the traditional system, and its parent company was sold to an even larger hotel conglomerate. This company paid a hefty price for substituting an elaborate team structure for the elegant power of great managers. Unfortunately, many other companies seem to be heading for a similar fate, albeit down a slightly different path. These companies have decided to hand off the catalyst role to other departments, like human resources or training. These departments then devise sophisticated selection systems or skills development classes and leave the manager to concentrate on getting the job done. The thinking seems to be that managers have enough to do without having to worry about things like selecting the right people or developing them. This thinking is laced with good intentions, but in fact, taking these activities away from managers actually starts to bleed the life out of the company. Healthy companies need strong bonds to develop between each manager and each employee. If the manager has not had a say in selecting his people, and if he is not invested in their current success and future growth, then those bonds wither. This doesn't mean that human resources or training departments should not give managers access to tools, systems, and classes. They should. But the chief focus should be on educating managers on how to use these tools, not on substituting the tools or the department for the manager. The core of the manager role consists of those four activities: selecting a person, setting expectations, motivating him, and developing him. You cannot centralize activities that can be done well only one-to-one, individual manager to individual employee. Managers are not just leaders in waiting. Managers do things right. Leaders do the right things. Conventional wisdom is proud of maxims like this. As we mentioned earlier, it uses them to encourage managers to label themselves leaders. It casts the managers as the dependable plodder, while the leader is the sophisticated executive, scanning the horizon and strategizing. Since most people would rather be a sophisticated executive than a dependable plodder, this advice seems positive and developmental. It isn't. It demeans the manager role, but doesn't succeed in doing much else. The difference between a manager and a leader is much more profound than most people think. The company that overlooks this difference will suffer for it. The most important difference between a great manager and a great leader is one of focus. Great managers look inward. They look inside the company, into each individual, into differences in the style, goals, needs, and motivation of each person. These differences are small and subtle, but great managers need to pay attention to them. These subtle differences guide them toward the right way to release each person's unique talents into performance. Great leaders, by contrast, look outward. They look out at the competition, out at the future, and out at alternative routes forward. They focus on broad patterns, finding connections and cracks, and they then press home their advantage where the resistance is weakest. They must be visionaries, strategic thinkers, and activators. When played well, this is without doubt a critical role. But it doesn't have much to do with the challenge of turning one individual's talents into performance. Great managers are not mini executives waiting for leadership to be thrust upon them. Great leaders are not simply managers who have developed sophistication. The core activities of a manager and a leader are simply different. It is entirely possible for a person to be a brilliant manager and a terrible leader. But it is just as possible for a person to excel as a leader and fail as a manager. And of course, a few exceptionally talented individuals excel at both. If companies confuse the two roles by expecting every manager to be a leader, or if they define leader as simply a more advanced form of manager, then the all-important catalyst role will soon be undervalued, poorly understood, and poorly played. Gradually, the company will fall apart. Keep it simple. Mike Kay, a senior trader for a large merchant bank, was stunned. The 30 traders under him were having their best year ever. The atmosphere on the desks was positive and supportive. His boss had given him a very generous bonus. Yet, he had just been told by human resources that he was the worst manager in the firm. They had come right out and said it, just like that. You're the worst manager in the firm. What on earth gave you that idea? Mike shot back. This 360-degree survey, they replied. Your direct reports rated you on these 25 different competencies. And although you scored very well on some of them, by our calculations, your overall average was the lowest in the firm. Over the next few months, you need to work on all of these low areas because this time next year, we're going to send this survey out again. It wasn't a threat, not quite, but Mike knew he was going to be in for a long year. Mike is the unfortunate victim of good intentions. Some companies, not wanting to fall into the trap of overlooking the importance of the manager, have rushed to the other extreme. They have tried to define the manager role in so much detail that they have ended up overburdening the poor manager with a frighteningly long list of behavioral competencies. Here, for example, is a sample of manager competencies a number of Fortune 50 companies use. Manage change, self-knowledge, establish plans, compelling vision, inspiration, strategic agility, troop rallying, risk-taking, take charge, business practices and controls, results orientation, manages diversity, broad perspective, calm under fire, interpersonally sensitive. Managers like Mike are rated on these competencies by their supervisor, direct reports, and sometimes their peers. Areas where they are doing well are given a cursory once-over. Areas where they score poorly are labeled areas of opportunity and become the focus for next year's individual development plan. You can just imagine how managers on the front line receive all this. How can I have a compelling vision yet also maintain a broad perspective? How can I take charge and be interpersonally sensitive at the same time? These are bizarre, backbreaking contortions. Creating super manager may seem like a good idea at the time, but as with Dr. Frankenstein's plan, the results always end up looking slightly ridiculous and a little scary. In the end, however well-intentioned, this kind of over-definition is unnecessary. A company should not force every manager to manage his people exactly the same way. Each manager will and should employ his own style. What a company can and should do is keep every manager focused on the four core activities of the catalyst role. Select a person, set expectations, motivate the person, and develop the person. No matter how many different styles they use, when managers play this role well, they lay the foundations. As far as is humanly possible, they release every single employee's talent into performance. The company becomes strong. The four keys. How do great managers play these roles? The catalyst role describes what great managers do. It tells us nothing about how they do it. So how do they do it? How do great managers release the potential energy of their people? How do they select people, set expectations, and then motivate and develop each and every one of their employees? There is a scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where a frustrated Indiana Jones is trying to discover where to start digging for the Ark of the Covenant. His adversaries, the Nazis, have already begun their excavations, and he is desperate to beat them to the prize. The location of the Ark is inscribed on an archaic ornamental headpiece, and a gnarled Egyptian fakir is turning it over in his hands, translating the Sanskrit symbols slowly, exactly. Suddenly, Indy stops pacing. Hearing the translation, he realizes that the Nazis have misunderstood the ancient text. Their calculations are flawed. Their measuring stick is too short. He turns to his partner and grins, "They're digging in the wrong place." When it comes to a manager's four core activities, conventional wisdom is digging in the wrong place. Its advice is close, very close. But when you look through the eyes of great managers, you realize that each element ever so slightly but so significantly misses the mark. Conventional wisdom encourages you to 1. Select a person based on his experience, intelligence, and determination. 2. Set expectations by defining the right steps. 3. Motivate the person by helping him identify and overcome his weaknesses. 4. Develop the person by helping him learn and get promoted. On the surface, there seems to be nothing wrong with this advice. In fact, many managers and many companies follow it devoutly. But all of it misses. You cannot build a great team simply by selecting people based on their experience, intelligence, and determination. Defining the right steps and fixing people's weaknesses are not the most effective ways to generate sustained performance. And preparing someone for the next rung on the ladder completely misses the essence of development. Remember the revolutionary insight common to great managers. People don't change that much. Don't waste time trying to put in what was left out. Try to draw out what was left in. That is hard enough. If you apply great managers' insight to the core activities of the catalyst role, this is what you see. When selecting someone, they select for talent, not simply experience, intelligence, or determination. When setting expectations, they define the right outcomes, not the right steps. When motivating someone, they focus on strengths, not on weaknesses. When developing someone, they help him find the right fit, not simply the next rung on the ladder. We've labeled this revolutionary approach the four keys of great managers. Taken together, the four keys reveal how these managers unlock the potential of each and every employee. Let's examine how each of these four keys works and how you can apply them to your own people. Chapter 3. The First Key. Select for Talent. Talent. How Great Managers Define It. The Right Stuff. The Decade of the Brain. Skills, Knowledge, and Talents. The World According to Talent. Talent. How Great Managers Find It. A Word from the Coach. Talent. How Great Managers Define It. Why does every role performed at excellence require talent? Typically, we associate talent only with celebrated excellence, with a strong emphasis on the word celebrated. We look at Michael Jordan swaying and knifing his way to the basket, and we know that neither his training nor his dogged determination is the prime source of his brilliance. He may have both of these, but then so do most other NBA players. Alone, these cannot explain why Jordan shines. Deep down, we know that his secret weapon is his talent. We look at Robert De Niro, and we think the same. He has talent. Tiger Woods, Jay Leno, Maya Angelou, they are all part of the talent club. They are blessed with a secret gift. For most of us, talent seems like a rare and precious thing, bestowed on special, faraway people. They are different, these people with talent. They are not us. Great managers disagree with this definition of talent. It is too narrow, too specialized. Instead, they define a talent as a recurring pattern of thought, feeling, or behavior that can be productively applied. The emphasis here is on the word recurring. Your talents, they say, are the behaviors you find yourself doing often. You have a mental filter that sifts through your world, forcing you to pay attention to some stimuli while others slip past you unnoticed. Your instinctive ability to remember names rather than just faces is a talent. Your need to alphabetize your spice rack and color code your wardrobe is a talent. So is your love of crossword puzzles, or your fascination with risk, or your impatience. Any recurring patterns of behavior that can be productively applied are talents. The key to excellent performance, of course, is finding the match between your talents and your role. This definition of talent is deceptively neutral, almost bland. Nevertheless, it guides great managers toward a momentous discovery. Every role performed at excellence requires talent, because every role performed at excellence requires certain recurring patterns of thought, feeling, or behavior. This means that great nurses have talent. So do great truck drivers and great teachers, great housekeepers, and great flight attendants. We will describe some of these talents later in this chapter. Whether excellence is celebrated or anonymous, great managers know that excellence is impossible without talent. The right stuff. Why is talent more important than experience, brain power, and willpower? For most roles, conventional wisdom advises managers to select for experience, for intelligence, or for determination. Talent, if mentioned at all, is an afterthought. Conventional wisdom says, experience makes the difference. Managers who place a special emphasis on experience pay closest attention to a candidate's work history. They pore over each person's resume, rating the companies who employed him and the kind of work he performed. They see his past as a window to his future. Brain power makes the difference. These managers put their faith in raw intelligence. They say that as long as you are smart, you can figure out most roles. Smart people simply figure it out better than the rest. When selecting people, these managers tend to favor articulate applicants blessed with high-powered academic records. Willpower makes the difference. This is the success is 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration school of thought. Managers from this school believe that the technical part of most roles can be taught, whereas the desire to achieve, to persist in the face of obstacles, cannot. When selecting people, they look for past evidence of grit. As far as it goes, great managers would agree with all of this advice. Experience can teach valuable lessons, intelligence is a boon, and willpower, which great managers actually label a talent, is almost impossible to teach. But conventional wisdom stops there. It fails to take into account that there are so many other kinds of talents, and that the right talents, more than experience, more than brain power, and more than willpower alone, are the prerequisites for excellence in all roles. Talents, such as a waiter's ability to form opinions, empathy in nurses, assertiveness in salespeople, or, in managers, the ability to individualize. Conventional wisdom assumes either that these behaviors can be trained after the person has been hired, or that these characteristics are relatively unimportant to performance on the job. Both assumptions are false. First, you cannot teach talent. You cannot teach someone to form strong opinions, to feel the emotions of others, to revel in confrontation, or to pick up on the subtle differences in how best to manage each person. You have to select for talents like these. We will explain why this is true later in the chapter. Second, talents like these prove to be the driving force behind an individual's job performance. It's not that experience, brain power, and willpower are unimportant. It's just that an employee's full complement of talents, what drives her, how she thinks, how she builds relationships, is more important. No matter how carefully you select for experience, brain power, or willpower, you still end up with a range in performance. In the retail company we described in Chapter 1, all store managers faced the same conditions and received the same training, yet some were 15% over their P&L budget and some were 30% below. In a large telecommunications company, the lower-performing customer service representatives take 3 times as many calls to resolve the same customer complaint as the best reps do. And since millions of customers call in each year and each call costs the company $10, this range in performance rightly gets management's attention. Similarly, a nationwide trucking company reports that its average drivers cover 125,000 miles per year and suffer 4 accidents per year. Yet one of its best drivers has just celebrated his 4 millionth mile of accident-free driving. There is a range in every role, no matter how simple it seems. While experience, brainpower, and willpower all affect performance significantly, only the presence of the right talents, recurring patterns of behavior that fit the role, can account for this range in performance. Only the presence of talents can explain why, all other factors being equal, some people excel in the role and some struggle. Let's take an extreme example where candidates were carefully selected for experience, brainpower, and willpower. They were expertly trained, and yet they still performed very differently from one another. Brigadier General Don Flickinger faced one of the more daunting management challenges in history. He had to find and train 7 men to perform an extremely difficult role. No one had ever performed this role before, and each man would have the opportunity to do it only once. The stakes were very high. Succeed in their role, and these men would restore America's faith in America. Fail, and they would add fuel to the Eastern Bloc's swelling self-confidence. As any manager would, the general spent a great deal of time and energy trying to find the right men for the job. First, he laid out his minimum criteria. They had to be no older than 39, no taller than 5'11", in excellent physical condition, and graduates of a military test pilot school with at least 1,500 hours of flying experience in jets. After passing muster, all successful applicants were subjected to the most exacting physical and psychological tests. Tests of physical endurance, how long can you support a column of mercury with one lung full of breath? Tests of mental stability, how long can you endure being locked up in a pitch-black soundproof sensory deprivation chamber with no idea when you will be released? Tests of pain suppression. If we drive a long needle into the big muscle at the base of your thumb and pass an electric current through it, what will you do? Eventually, the general found his 7 men. He found Alan Shepard, Gus Grissom, John Glenn, Scott Carpenter, Wally Schirra, Gordon Cooper, and Deke Slayton. He found the 7 astronauts of the Mercury space program. And like any good manager, after having found them, he trained them. They were taught everything from the esoterics of gravitation and rocket propulsion to the very practical matter of how to control yaw, roll, and pitch in the vacuum of space. They were given the best teachers, the most up-to-date equipment, and the time to focus. Over 2 years, they acquired a wealth of new skills and knowledge. By May 5, 1961, they were ready. Alan Shepard's 15-minute suborbital flight was the first of 6 successful missions. Deke Slayton fell foul of a pre-existing heart condition, which culminated in Gordon Cooper's 34-hour, 22-orbit marathon. By the time Cooper splashed down on May 17, 1963, the Russians had been caught up with, America's pride had been restored, and the platform had been laid for the leap to the moon. From almost every angle, the MISS, Man in Space Soonest, program was a model of project execution excellence. Superior technology, combined with carefully selected and well-trained employees, all focused on a specific mission and buoyed by the hopes of a nation. No wonder it succeeded. But look closer. When you examine the Mercury program through a strictly managerial lens, you do not see a picture-perfect project. You see 6 very different missions. And putting aside for a moment the spectacular dimension of the endeavor and the inspirational bravery of each astronaut, The quality of the performance in each of the six missions can be comparatively ranked. Too textbook, too heroic, and too mediocre. Look closer still and you realize that, in most instances, the individual astronauts themselves caused this variation. Alan Shepard and Wally Schirra, both career military men, executed their duties perfectly. No drama, no surprises, textbook missions. John Glenn and Gordon Cooper were a little special. Glenn was the hero's hero. Cooper was so laid back, he actually fell asleep on the launch pad. But both of them faced severe mechanical difficulties and then responded with cool heroism and technical brilliance. Cooper even managed to achieve the most accurate splashdown of all, despite the complete failure of his automatic re-entry guidance systems. The performances of Gus Grissom and Scott Carpenter were rather less impressive. Grissom piloted a clean flight, but he appeared to panic after his capsule splashed down. It seems he blew the escape hatch too early. The capsule filled with water, and it sank to the seafloor 16,000 feet below. NASA never recovered the 3,000-pound capsule. Carpenter, meanwhile, was so excited to be up in space that while in orbit, he maneuvered his capsule this way and that until he had used up almost all his fuel. When it came time to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, he was unable to make the appropriate corrections to his angle of re-entry and ended up splashing down 250 miles from his designated landing site. He was lucky. If he had been a couple of degrees shallower in his approach, the capsule would have bounced off the atmosphere and spun off into space for eternity. NASA must have looked at the performance of their astronauts and wondered, why this range in performance? We selected for experience, for intelligence, and for determination. They all had the same training and the same tools. So why didn't they perform the same? Why did Cooper excel while Carpenter struggled? Why did Glenn behave so calmly and Grissom less so? The answer is that despite being similar in many ways, and all exceptionally accomplished in comparison with the rest of us, these six men possessed different talents. What does that mean? It means that although each of these men faced the same stimuli, the way they reacted to these stimuli and then behaved was very different. During orbit, Carpenter was so excited that he couldn't stop playing with the altitude jets. Yet Cooper felt so calm, he actually slept through some of his orbits. At takeoff, Grissom's pulse rate spurted to 150. Glenn's never climbed above 80. Same stimuli, vastly different reactions. Why? Because each man filtered the world differently. Each man's mental filter sorted and sifted, making one man acutely aware of stimuli to which another was blind. Bobbing in the water after splashdown, the dependable Wally Schirra was so focused on doing it right that he stayed in the capsule for 4 hours to complete every step of his post-flight routine. His mental filter blocked out any twinges of claustrophobia. Gus Grissom's didn't. All indications are that barely 5 minutes after splashing down, he felt the tiny capsule closing in around him. His mental filter, no longer able to dampen his growing panic, told him to get out, to escape now. The hatch blew. You have a filter. A characteristic way of responding to the world around you. We all do. Your filter tells you which stimuli to notice and which to ignore, which to love and which to hate. It creates your innate motivations. Are you competitive, altruistic, or ego-driven? It defines how you think. Are you disciplined or laissez-faire, practical or strategic? It forges your prevailing attitudes. Are you optimistic or cynical, calm or anxious, empathetic or cold? It creates all of your distinct patterns of thought, feeling, and behavior. In effect, Your filter is the source of your talents. Your filter is unique. It sorts through every stimulus and creates a world that only you can see. This filter can account for the fact that the same stimulus produces vastly different reactions in you from those in the person next to you. For example, imagine you are asleep on a long flight when the plane encounters some high-level turbulence. Do you wake up, convinced that the main reason you haven't heard any explanation from the cockpit is that the pilots are too busy strapping on their parachutes? Or do you stay sleeping, a slightly more vigorous head nodding, the only sign that your body notices the bumps? Imagine you are at a party with some people you know and some you don't. Do you find yourself compelled to dive into the crowd of strangers and swim easily through the throng, remembering names, telling stories, and turning strangers into friends? Or do you hug the corner with your significant other, scanning the room for anyone else you might know, and nervously rehearsing the one joke you might have to tell? Imagine you are arguing with your boss. As the argument intensifies, do you find yourself becoming colder, clearer, and more articulate as your brain hands you one perfect word after another? Or despite all your preparation, do your emotions rise and your brain shut down, separating you from all of those carefully rehearsed words? Because every human being is guided by his unique filter, the same situation produces different reactions. What is ridiculously easy for one person is excruciatingly difficult for you. What is stimulating to you is tedious for someone else. All truck drivers face the same situation. Miles of road, an unwieldy load, and swarms of little cars buzzing around them. They all have the same training and the same experience. But some of these drivers drive twice as many miles as their colleagues, yet suffer half as many accidents. Why? Their filter. When you ask the best drivers, what do you think about when you are driving? They all say the same thing. They all say, I think about what I would do if that car pulled out right now, if that pedestrian decided to try to cross before the light change, if my brakes failed. While other drivers are thinking about the next rest stop, how much longer they have to go, or other more diverting subjects, the best drivers are playing what-if games, anticipating scenarios, and planning evasive maneuvers. Same stimuli, different reactions, very different performance. Likewise, all customer service representatives face the same situation. Thousands of telephone calls coming in from disgruntled customers. They all have the same technology and the same experience and training. Yet the best reps take a third fewer calls than the average reps to solve the same complaint. Why? Because, for the best, many of whom are shy in person, the phone is an instrument of intimacy. It offers them shelter from the customer while at the same time giving them the chance to reach through the phone and connect more quickly and more closely than if they were standing face to face. They picture what room the customer is in. They imagine what the customer looks like. They smile and wave their hands, even though they know that the customer cannot see what they are doing. Instinctively, their filter takes every disembodied voice and fashions a full human being. On the other end of the line, the customer feels the difference. This filtering of their world is not a conscious, rational process. It does not happen once a week, allowing them the luxury of sitting back and weighing up all alternatives before deciding on the most sensible course of action. Rather, their filter is constantly at work, sorting, sifting, and creating their world in real time. Yours does the same. It's happening now as you read this book. Maybe, just at this moment, you have looked up from the page to pause and think through something. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you are speed reading this so you can get to the end of the chapter before your flight ends. Maybe the flight has nothing to do with it. You are simply a compulsive speed reader. Maybe you have just picked up your pen to underline this paragraph, or to make a scrawled note in the margin. Maybe you hate it when people mark up books. Your filter is always working. Of all the things you could possibly do or feel or think, your filter is constantly telling you the few things you must do or feel or think. Your filter, more than your race, sex, age, or nationality, is you. The decade of the brain. How much of a person can the manager change? How much of you can be changed? If you hate meeting new people, can you learn to love breaking the ice with strangers? If you shy away from confrontation, can you be made to revel in the cut and thrust of debate? If the bright lights make you sweat, can you be taught to thrill to the challenge of public speaking? Can you carve new talents? Many managers and many companies assume that the answer to all these questions is yes. With the best of intentions, they tell their employees that everyone has the same potential. They encourage their employees to be open and dedicated to learning new ways to behave. They help them climb up the company hierarchy. They send their employees to training classes designed to teach all manner of new behaviors, empathy, assertiveness, relationship building, innovation, and strategic thinking. From their perspective, one of the most admirable qualities an employee can possess is the willingness to transform herself through learning and self-discipline. The world's great managers don't share this perspective. Remember their mantra: people don't change that much. Don't waste time trying to put in what was left out. Try to draw out what was left in. That is hard enough. They believe that a person's talents, his mental filter, are what was left in. Therefore, no amount of smile school training is going to transform the person who is intimidated by strangers into a smooth wooer. Despite his best efforts, the person who becomes less articulate the angrier he gets will never acquire what it takes to excel at debate. And no matter how much he understands the value of win-win scenarios, the intense competitor will never learn to love them. A person's mental filter is as enduring and unique as her fingerprint. This is a radical belief that flies in the face of decades of self-help mythology. But over the last 10 years, neuroscience has started to confirm what these great managers have long believed. In 1990, Congress and the President declared the 90s the decade of the brain. They authorized funding, sponsored conventions, and generally did everything in their power to help the scientific community unravel the mysteries of the human mind. Their encouragement accelerated ongoing efforts by industry, academia, and research organizations. According to Lewis L. Judd, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, the pace of progress in neuroscience is so great that 90% of all we know about the brain we learned in the last 10 years. In the past, we had to infer the workings of the brain from the behavior of the patient. Today, new technologies like positron emission tomography, PET, and magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, actually allow scientists to see the brain at work. Armed with these and other tools, we have taken giant steps in learning. We have learned that the causes of mental illness are as biological as any physical disease. We have learned why the neurotransmitter dopamine calms us down and why serotonin fires us up. We have learned that, contrary to what we used to think, our memories are not stored in one particular place, but are scattered like clues on every highway and back alley of our brain. And we have learned how the brain grows. Given the pace of scientific discovery in this arena, we will surely advance our knowledge dramatically over the next few years. But this is what we know today. At birth, a child's brain contains 100 billion neurons, more brain cells than there are stars in the Milky Way. These cells will grow and die regularly throughout the child's life, but their number will remain roughly the same. These cells are the raw material of the mind, but they are not the mind. The mind of the child lives between these cells, in the connections between the cells, in the synapses. During the first 15 years of life, the carving of these synaptic connections is where the drama unfolds. From the day she is born, the child's mind begins to reach out, aggressively, exuberantly. Beginning at the center of the brain, every neuron sends out thousands and thousands of signals. They are trying to talk to one another, to communicate, to make a connection. Imagine everyone alive today simultaneously trying to get in touch with 150,000 other people, and you will get some idea of the wonderful scale, complexity, and vitality of the young mind. By the time the child reaches her third birthday, the number of successful connections made is colossal, up to 15,000 synaptic connections for each of her 100 billion neurons. But this is too many. She's overloaded with the volume of information whirling around inside her head. She needs to make sense of it all, her sense. So, during the next 10 years or so, her brain refines and focuses its network of connections. The stronger synaptic connections become stronger still. The weaker ones wither away. Dr. Harry Chugani, professor of neurology at Wayne State University Medical School, likens this pruning process to a highway system. Roads with the most traffic get widened. The ones that are rarely used fall into disrepair. Scientists are still arguing about what causes some mental highways to be used more regularly than others. Some contend that the child's genetic inheritance predisposes her toward certain mental pathways. Others claim that the way she is raised has a significant effect on which pathways will survive the Darwinian pruning and which will die. These views are not mutually exclusive, but whatever their nature-nurture bias, few disagree on the outcome of this mental pruning. By the time the child reaches her early teens, she has half as many synaptic connections as she did when she was three. Her brain has carved out a unique network of connections. She has some beautiful, frictionless, traffic-free four-lane highways where the connections are smooth and strong. And she has some barren wastelands where no signal at all makes it across. If she ends up with a four-lane highway for empathy, she will feel every emotion of those around her as though it were her own. By contrast, if she has a wasteland for empathy, she will be emotionally blind, forever saying the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person. Not out of malice, but simply out of an inability to pick up the frequency of the emotional signals being sent. Likewise, if she has a four-lane highway for confrontation, she will be that lucky person whose brain just hands her one perfect word after another during the heat of a debate. If she has a wasteland for confrontation, she will find that her brain always shuts her mouth down at the most critical moments of a debate. These mental pathways are her filter. They produce the recurring pattern of behaviors that make her unique. They tell her which stimuli to respond to and which to ignore. They define where she will excel and where she will struggle. They create all of her enthusiasms and all of her indifferences. The carving of these pathways is the carving of her character. Neuroscience is telling us that beyond her mid-teens, there is a limit to how much of her character she can recarve. This doesn't mean that she cannot change. As we will describe later, she can learn new skills and new knowledge. She can alter her values. She can develop a greater sense of self-awareness and a greater capacity for self-regulation. And if she does indeed have a wasteland for confrontation, then with enough training, coaching, encouragement, and help, she can probably build a thin path so that she is at least able to cope with confrontation. But it does mean that in terms of these mental pathways, No amount of training, coaching, or encouragement will enable her to turn her barren wastelands into frictionless four-lane highways. Neuroscience confirms what great managers know. Her filter and the recurring patterns of behavior that it creates are enduring. In the most important ways, she is permanently, wonderfully unique. So are you. And of course, so are the people you hire. Skills, knowledge, and talents. What is the difference among the three? Great managers are not troubled by the fact that there is a limit to how much they can rewire someone's brain. Instead, they view it as a happy confirmation that people are different. There's no point wishing away this individuality. It's better to nurture it. It's better to help someone understand his filter and then channel it toward productive behavior. So if you can't carve out new talents for your people, what, if anything, can you change about them? First, you can help them discover their hidden talents. As we will discuss in more detail in Chapter 5, the best managers are adept at spotting a glimpse of a talent in someone and then repositioning him so that he can play to that talent more effectively. Second, a manager can teach her employees new skills and new knowledge. Here we come to one of the most profound insights great managers share. Skills, knowledge, and talents are distinct elements of a person's performance. The distinction among the three is that skills and knowledge can easily be taught, whereas talents cannot. Combined in the same person, they create an enormously potent compound. But you must never confuse talents with skills and knowledge. If you do, you may waste a great deal of time and money trying to teach something that is fundamentally unteachable. Skills are the how-tos of a role. They are capabilities that can be transferred from one person to another. For accountants, arithmetic is a skill. If for some strange reason the neophyte accountant doesn't know how to do arithmetic, he can still be taught. For pilots, the mechanics of yaw, roll, and pitch are a skill. For administrative assistants, knowing how to use Microsoft Word or Excel is a skill. For nurses, the details of how to give a safe injection are a skill. The best way to teach a skill is to break down the total performance into steps, which the student then reassembles. And naturally, the best way to learn a skill is to practice. Your knowledge is simply what you are aware of. There are two kinds of knowledge: factual knowledge, things you know, and experiential knowledge, understandings you have picked up along the way. Factual knowledge for an accountant would be knowing the rules of double-entry bookkeeping. For flight attendants, the Federal Aviation Administration's safety regulations are factual knowledge. For salespeople, their products, features, and benefits are factual knowledge. For engineers, the National Bureau of Standards' electrical frequencies are factual knowledge. Factual knowledge can and should be taught. Experiential knowledge is a little different. It is less tangible, and therefore much harder to teach. Acquiring it is your responsibility. You must discipline yourself to stop, look back on past experiences, and try to make sense of them. Through this kind of musing or reflection, you can start to see patterns and connections. You can start to understand. Some of these understandings are practical. For example, over a number of years, an accountant comes to know a variety of ways to shield a client's assets from excessive taxation. A retail store manager, reflecting back on customer buying patterns, now knows which products to highlight during the holiday season. A teacher, remembering the glazed eyes of past students, is now prepared with videos and field trips to spice up the particularly stodgy sections of the course. Some understandings are more conceptual. Your awareness of who you are and how you come across to others is experiential knowledge. It comes with time if you are listening. In the same way, your values, those aspects of life that you hold dear, are experiential knowledge. As you make your choices, sometimes compromising, sometimes holding firm, you come to realize that certain aspects of your life are more important than others. These critical aspects become your values, guiding the choices you make in the future. Some of these values will remain constant throughout your life. Others will change with time and reflection. Talents are different phenomena altogether. Talents are the four-lane highways in your mind that carve your recurring patterns of thought, feeling, or behavior. Through Gallup's studies of great accountants, we have discovered that one of their most important talents is an innate love of precision. Ask a great accountant, not any accountant, but a great accountant, when he smiles, and he will tell you, when the books balance. When the books balance, his world is perfect. He may not show it, but inside he is aglow. All he can think about is, oh, when can I do that again? This might seem rather odd to you, but if you think about it, for the person blessed with an innate love of precision, accountancy must be a wonderful job. Every time his books balance, he experiences absolute perfection in his work. How many of us can claim that? A love of precision is not a skill, nor is it knowledge. It is a talent. If you don't possess it, you will never excel as an accountant. If someone does not have this talent as part of his filter, there's very little a manager can do to inject it. Three kinds of talent. At Gallup, we have studied the talents of more than 150 distinct roles, and in the process, identified a multitude of different talents. As you would imagine, the talents needed to excel at these roles vary greatly. An all-star goalie in the NHL possesses rather different talents than an excellent Catholic deacon. The best nurses are not cut from the same cloth as the best stockbrokers. Fortunately, we have found a way to simplify these diverse talents into three basic categories: striving talents, thinking talents, and relating talents. Striving talents explain the why of a person. They explain why he gets out of bed every day and why he is motivated to push and push just a little bit harder. Is he driven by his desire to stand out? Or is good enough for him? Is he intensely competitive, intensely altruistic, or both? Does he define himself by his technical competence, or does he just want to be liked? Thinking talents explain the how of a person. They explain how she thinks, how she weighs alternatives, and how she comes to her decisions. Is she focused, or does she like to leave all of her options open? Is she disciplined and structured, or does she love surprises? Is she a linear, practical thinker, or is she strategic, always playing mental what-if games with herself? Relating talents explain the who of a person. They explain whom he trusts, whom he builds relationships with, whom he confronts, and whom he ignores. Is he drawn to win strangers over, or is he at ease only with his close friends? Does he think that trust must be earned? Or does he extend trust to everyone, with the belief that most will prove worthy of it? Does he confront people dispassionately, or does he avoid confrontation until finally exploding in an emotional tirade? Striving, thinking, and relating. These are the three basic categories of talent. Within each, you will have your own combination of four-lane highways and barren wastelands. No matter how much you might yearn to be different, your combination of talents and the recurring behaviors it creates will remain stable and familiar to you and to others throughout your life. A couple of mind games. If you want to experience firsthand the distinct properties of skills, knowledge, and talents, try this little game. I'll describe the words here, and you'll also find them on the bonus material. Can you see the well-known phrase or saying in this word? MILL1ON. The solution? One in a million.